We'll take a wild guess that people have dreamed of flying like birds ever since the invention of birds and people. Sadly, these heavy wingless bodies we have keep us pretty well confined to the surface of the Earth. But you can't blame a species for trying to fly without the aid of an actual aircraft. The exploits of the people who try the hardest, we're talking base jumpers and wingsuit flyers primarily, are recounted in the book Bird Dream, Adventures at the Extremes of Human Flight by Matt Higgins. Matt is a freelance journalist with work published in a range of publications from Popular Mechanics to the New York Times to ESPN the magazine. Bird Dream came out in hardcover last year and is recently out in paperback. Matt, thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange today.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
You had covered so-called extreme sports for a while. Was this just a natural next investigation?
Yeah, it really was. I didn't know much about wingsuits or base jumping, really, beyond what I had seen online when an editor at the New York Times asked me to look into it. So, and I pretty quickly recognized that there are a lot of similarities between the athletes themselves and the kinds of feats they were pursuing. Between action sports and base jumping and wingsuit flying.
You bring up a major point early, which is that the guys with the wingsuits, I never stopped to think about this, they have a little issue with landing.
Yeah, they do. And that is mainly what captivated me from the start, was that some of them were talking about landing without a wingsuit, or without a parachute, that is, and that would be a first for aviation and probably the closest approximation to, you know, pure human flight that anybody, you know, has come up with. So that idea, that suggestion really captivated me and sort of sent me on my way as a reporter, you know, wanting to research and learn everything I could about this quest.
So the two major approaches here, the wingsuit flying and the base jumping, is the other. And so for the folks who might not have heard about it before, what is base jumping?
Well, BASE is an acronym, and it stands for Buildings, Antenna, Spans, which are bridges, and Earth, which are cliffs. And those are all the objects that people jump off of with parachutes. So it's similar to skydiving in a sense, except you're jumping off of a fixed object, and usually you're dealing with much lower altitude and much more danger as a result.
So is the appeal of base jumping in the danger, or is it in the object from which the person jumps?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think certainly people who find base jumping appealing are attracted to doing dangerous things. There's no getting around the fact that it's one of the, if not the most, you know, dangerous sports ever created. But jumping off the objects themselves typically have a special appeal for practitioners. Not all of the objects are created equal, as it were. A bridge is generally considered to be the safest object because even if you have an off-heading opening, that is, if your parachute opens facing in the wrong direction, and you can usually fly beneath the bridge without crashing into anything, whereas if you jump off a cliff, for example, you're flying in the wrong direction, you're headed right back at the cliff, and you've got some problems that you got to figure out really quickly.
Ah, I could see the advantage of a bridge then, or something like the St. Louis Arch. You have a lot of space under you and around you.
Exactly. Probably the most dangerous object is a building, because you're dealing, not only could you turn around and fly right back into the building once your parachute has opened, but you're typically landing in an urban area where there are a lot of obstacles and possibly people, vehicles on the ground that you have to be aware of. And I guess it probably goes without saying, but you almost never have permission to jump off of a building. So you're doing, you know, you're trying to do it in a clandestine manner, so that adds another layer of complexity and risk.
And there's the next question on my list. What's the prevailing view of base jumping from the legal powers that be?
Well, it's very rarely expressly prohibited, although New York City does have a law expressly prohibiting base jumping because, you know, inevitably Manhattan attracts people who want to base jump because of all of the tall, prominent buildings there. But in most cases, someone who is base jumping is maybe guilty of trespassing. They're in an area where they're not supposed to be in the first place, whether they may be climbing a transmission antenna to jump off, and they're not supposed to be there. So they might, if they're caught, they could be charged with trespassing or reckless endangerment or something like that. The national parks in the United States don't permit base jumping, so some of the best cliffs suited for base jumping are off limits. Bureau of Land Management property, though, does not prohibit base jumping. People will jump off cliffs on those lands, but oftentimes there's no infrastructure, and so on those lands, so it's very difficult to get access, and there aren't oftentimes suitable landing areas. So it's really you find a lot of base jumping happens overseas because in Europe in particular, you have a lot of cliffs that you can jump off of, and there are no laws to prevent you from doing so.
Wow. Okay, we'll compare and contrast the differences in approaches to base jumping and wingsuit flying between here and the rest of the world. When we come back and talk more with Matt Higgins, his book is Bird Dream, Adventures at the Extremes of Human Flight. And these are some pretty extreme things, some illustrations in the book, too. And, of course, there's always a bunch of YouTube videos you could look at to help describe what goes on with some of the characters in here. We'll meet Jeb Corliss and Gary Bullock, among others, as we go through the conversation with Matt. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Matt Higgins, Bird Dream, and your phone calls and emails in a minute 25. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the journalist Matt Higgins. He's written a book about the people who take to the skies without the benefit of an airplane. We're talking base jumpers and wingsuit flyers. And, of course, the wingsuit flyers have to bring parachutes as well because it turns out they can't land in the suits. We'll get into more detail on that. Bird Dream, Adventures at the Extremes of Human Flight is the book. Matt Higgins, our guest. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange with questions and comments about this very dangerous pursuit. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So the wingsuits we're talking about, these are the ones that look like, they make the people look like flying squirrels because they've got big amounts of fabric between the legs and between the arms and the body. And I guess the question I've always wondered about is, how were these suits tested in the first place, Matt?
Well, typically the manufacturers will test them. They'll come up with a design for a suit, and they will take them out to a skydiving center, and they will jump out of airplanes with them. And in skydiving, you're jumping from a much higher altitude, typically 13,000 feet, and you deploy your parachute somewhere around 3,000 feet. So if you have any kinds of issues or hiccups, you have more time and altitude to correct and land safely. So usually a manufacturer will test the suits himself and have some other trusted confidants to test the suits. And after many iterations, design iterations and test jumps, he'll put the suits out to market for other wingsuit pilots to buy and fly.
Well, I have to wonder about the cost of doing business in that field, though. I mean, are there huge liability issues in anything like that, or do they have to have 3-page releases or 35-page releases for people to sign when they buy the suits?
That's a good question. I think there's an inherent risk involved, and it's an assumed risk. It's like skiing, for example, which tends not to be as risky, but you are assuming a certain amount of risk when you put on a wingsuit and you jump out of an airplane or you jump off of a cliff. So the risk is really assumed by the practitioner, and that's really pretty consistent with the spirit of the sport. People who do these types of activities tend to be self-reliant. They understand that what they're doing is dangerous and that there's really nobody there to save them, that they have to kind of fall back on their own preparation and skills and judgment to be successful. So it's not entirely unregulated. I mean, certainly the FAA has a lot to say about skydiving in this country, but and other parachute governing bodies, but it is it's still pretty free and unencumbered area. I guess maybe the trial lawyers just haven't sniffed it out.
Well, they haven't been successful in keeping motorcycles off the street either, I suppose. So there is always a certain amount of risk we're allowed to take for ourselves. A couple of calls here, starting with Grumpy John in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Matt Higgins, the author of Bird Dream.
Yeah, I had questions about the squirrel suits. You answered one. Parachutes are necessary to stop. The other one was, what's your physical strength requirements for hanging out there for 5 minutes, holding yourself up with a squirrel suit on? And thanks very much.
Okay, thanks for that, Grumpy John. Good questions. I really have to wonder about the physical fitness of somebody who's going to keep his arms out at his sides and try to keep wind in his wings on the way down.
Yeah, truly, most of these pilots are excellent athletes and fit, in pretty good shape. But the physical strain is not as great. I'm told. I should say I've actually never flown a wingsuit myself, but I've been told that it's not a tremendous physical strain on you, because the flights tend to be fairly short. They're not It would be extraordinary for a flight to last for 5 minutes, even in a skydiving environment. You would need to jump from such an extraordinary height. In base jumping, the flight may be less than a minute. So you're not put under a tremendous amount of strain for a long time, so it doesn't require that kind of physical stamina that some other sports would. It's and a lot of pilots describe it as when they're really kind of in the zone and they're really operating at peak performance, they're just kind of floating, and it feels somewhat effortless to them.
Although some people cut it a little finer, and that brings us into the discussion of Jeb Corliss. One of the first places I went when I was reading the book was onto the YouTube video of Jeb Corliss taking a wingsuit through the crack in Switzerland, and he's flying so close to the ground that somebody who's holding balloons for him to test his altitude actually has to squat down and get out of the way. So how fast does he go? Would you say 170 miles an hour?
Well, in that scenario, he was going over 100 miles an hour when he flew past the head of his accomplice. Typically, in a dive scenario like that, the pilots are going 100 miles an hour or more. They could be going up to 170 miles an hour. You need different speeds to get different flight characteristics. The faster you're going, obviously, the quicker your response will be when you want to move away from danger. If you're kind of floating and gliding slowly, you don't have that same ability to make a hard input and turn away or gain some altitude and get away from danger. So in that scenario, though, Jeb was traveling over 100 miles an hour, and it was as you can see on the video, it was extremely close. I don't recall. There's a song that accompanies the video. You can't hear it, but there's a kind of an unholy roar when he's tearing through the air when you're there to witness it live and in person.
It's a pretty strange sound. So tell us a bit about Jeb Corliss. He's a guy who's earned a reputation on several levels, it would appear. Tell us about him and how he got into the business.
Well, Jeb was, he started out, he had seen base jumping on television when he was a teenager. And he was a kind of a melancholy kid. He didn't really fit in with a lot of his peers while he was growing up. And he was always kind of struggling to find his place. And he saw base jumping when he was a teenager and knew immediately that that was for him. That's what he wanted to do. It took many years for him to realize that dream. He had to become a skydiver first and become an accomplished, learn how to jump out of an airplane and manipulate his body, and then how to fly his parachute. And I should say that's typical of all of these guys and women too. They're all experienced skydivers. That's sort of the stepping stone or the gateway drug to base jumping, I guess you might say. But it's you take that step first, acquire the skills. And Jeb was, he had skydived for a number of years and got the requisite skill, and then took a course in base jumping when he was in his early 20s. And he just, he had an innate skill for it. Mentally, he was able to handle the high stress loads that come with, jumping off of an object at low altitude. And when things go wrong, he was able to mostly, make the right decisions quickly and act quickly. And he just seemed suited for it. And he continued on. He was the sport had been pretty much an underground activity. You got involved in it through mentors. This was the era before YouTube, so there really wasn't any video out there, and there was no, you kind of had to have somebody sponsor you and give you entree into this kind of private world. And he met some mentors in California, where he's from, and he eventually started traveling around the world and jumping at all these extraordinary places, and just took off from there. As I say, he kind of came along at the right time, in the sense that the sport was just starting to emerge into the mainstream consciousness, and there was online video, and his videos were always spectacular, whether he succeeded or not, and oftentimes, his failures were as extraordinary as his success. And he's been hurt many, many times over, and he's come. A lot of his friends have died. A lot of his peers have died, and he's still going strong almost 20 years later. It's really extraordinary. It speaks to his to his skill and his resolve. And he's probably the main guy, though, to have transcended the sport into the mainstream. As you said, his YouTube videos have been seen, tens of millions of times.
Lots of cameras, lots of editing, and it's very impressive stuff. One of the first things I checked was to make sure he is still alive. I didn't want to talk about him in the past tense if that was not the case. Bird Dream, Adventures at the Extremes of Human Flight is the book we're talking about. We're talking about Jeb Corliss, who's one of the major practitioners of base jumping and wingsuit flying. Matt Higgins is the author of the book and our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. You can join in at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Here's John in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Exchange.
Hi, thank you. So I got a couple questions. First of all is, you guys sound like Evel Knievel. So what other kind of crazy, wild stuff do you do? Because I'm a chicken. And then second, are there any women involved with this?
All right, good for that. Thanks, John. Appreciate it.
I don't base jump or wingsuit fly. I've made two skydives and managed to hurt myself on one of them. So I think my I may skydive again, but I don't have any plans to right now. But I will say most of the people, most of the wingsuit pilots in the world have come from a background of some other type of extreme or adventure sport. Jeb Corliss was an accomplished scuba diver really early on in his life as a teenager. Many of these guys are alpine skiers. Many are surfers or ride motocross. And as I said, virtually every one of them has been a skydiver and is still a skydiver. So, yeah, there's this whole cohort of extreme and adventure sports, tend to appeal to people who want to do wingsuit flying. And that includes the women. There are women, prominent women, one of whom is named Roberta Mancino, and she's an Italian fashion model who is also a black belt in martial arts and a scuba diver, and she's kind of wired the same way as the guys. You know, she's right there with them, base jumping and wingsuit flying. Another woman who comes to mind is an American who lives in Moab, Utah. Her name is Steph Davis, and she's an accomplished rock climber. She's one of the top women in the world and has been for a long time, and she's also a really skilled base jumper and wingsuit pilot. So it's usually through other sports and of course ultimately skydiving that people eventually graduate to base jumping and wingsuit flying, which is you really kind of need to make that progression, I think, because the sport requires such precision and is so unforgiving of mistakes that you kind of have to hone your mind and body to be able to survive.
So you do give a good history lesson in here. You point out the fact that parachutes were envisioned at least as far back as Leonardo da Vinci, if not further back than that. When were the first successful parachutes deployed?
Well, parachutes were used for different reasons at different times in history, it wasn't until the late 1800s when hot air ballooning had reached enough of a formative stage that it could be done somewhat safely, that parachutes started to take on, they started to work more reliably, I should say. But there were no real, parachute, means for falling. It comes from the French, it's a French term. There were no standard design specs. Parachute standards didn't really come into play until after the early days of aviation, and I don't really get into this in the book, but I've heard anecdotally that early in the early days of aviation, particularly in the military environment, there were arguments about whether to even equip the pilots with parachutes, because there was some thought that they would if they wouldn't stay with the plane. In other words, they would jump out to save their lives. And military leadership felt that perhaps they should, stay with the plane and fight till the bitter end. So parachutes didn't really, based on my research, start to take hold until the early part of the 20th century, when aviation started to develop, after World War One.
All right, so we had the need for parachutes to get people out of damaged planes. We had skydiving coming along about mid-century, it seems like. But then base jumping, is there a bit of a split among people who jump out of planes and about base jumping? I mean, there are some people who do skydive who think base jumping is for knuckleheads.
Yeah, that is true. Jeb Corliss will often say that you know, the average person thinks a skydiver is crazy. A skydiver thinks a base jumper is crazy, and base jumpers think that I'm crazy. So, most skydivers will never graduate to base jumping because it is much more dangerous. It's much more compressed time and altitude, so you have to be much more precise, and you're only carrying one parachute in a base jumping environment because there isn't enough time to carry a reserve. If your first parachute doesn't operate properly, you know, that's it, and you can't correct the malfunction immediately, then you're finished.
Wow.
or you're hurt badly. So, there definitely is a bit of a schism there between the two communities.
Okay, more about the details of base jumping and some of the equipment used and what happens with wingsuit flying and the wingsuit landing project, all coming up as we talk more with Matt Higgins about his book, Bird Dream, Adventures at the Extremes of Human Flight. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Matt and you in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the freelance journalist Matt Higgins. He's written for The New York Times and ESPN the Magazine and Popular Mechanics, among others. Put together a book about base jumpers, the people who jump off of buildings and cliffs and the like, and with parachutes, and people who do the same thing with wingsuits. His book is called Bird Dream, Adventures at the Extremes of Human Flight, out in paperback for a couple of months now. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange with questions or comments about the exploits of the daring young men who don't have flying machines. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Even though you mentioned a bit of a schism within parachute jumping, that some people think that, you know, the skydivers think that the base jumpers are kind of nuts. There is something of a code of ethics among base jumpers, though, as you point out, a lot of things that they will and will not do.
That's true. Because they operated for so long as a clandestine group, they never wanted to attract attention to themselves because they learned early on in their history that when people realized what they were doing, they often tried to stop them, including the authorities. So they found it better to go underground, and so the code of ethics kind of developed around that. And one of the idea basically is to leave no trace, which is to, you know, the best type of base jump would be one in which nobody knew that you actually did it, except maybe your friends who were there to witness it.
There's a great story in the book about a guy who actually got out of bed in the middle of the night with his wife in the hotel room, went out and made his base jump and slid back in before dawn.
Yeah, that really epitomizes the base jumping code of ethics. Because it's such a it's so startling and frightening to people and to the authorities. Base jumpers really tried to be their own best ambassadors. You needed to have a mentor bring you into the group, and that person was essentially vetting you and saying that this person I'm bringing in has the skills and the mindset and the attitude to join us, to join this sort of secret society, if you will. And so you didn't want to do any, you wouldn't as a member of this group want to do anything to jeopardize that. That ethic has changed quite a bit in the past several years, though, with the introduction of these POV cameras, like GoPro cameras. Now everybody who makes a base jump, it seems, is wearing one, and they are trying, you know, they're going to post it online and so that the world can see what they've done. There are still people who kind of eschew that publicity, but it's possible, or it seems possible to a lot of people now, that they can get famous and maybe even have a career as a base jumper or as a wingsuit pilot. So that, although a lot of the principles of the code of ethics still stand today, this idea that it's a secret society has become less of, there's been less of an emphasis placed on that.
We've talked about the name Jeb Corliss already, who's done some pretty amazing things in wingsuits. Gary Bullock also got some fairly prominent mention in the book. Tell us a bit about him.
Well, Gary he grew up outside of London, and he, was trying to find his way in life, just like most people. And he didn't really seem to fit in a lot of, and this makes him similar to Jeb in some respects. He didn't really seem to fit into most compartments. He just had a desire to kind of blaze his own way. He was a skier, an alpine skier. He tried to build a career as an alpine skier, and he had some success and traveled around continental Europe for a while. But when it became clear that he wasn't going to win the World Cup or be able to continue as a competitive skier, he joined the military, and with the idea that he could eventually start a career as a stuntman, and it worked out for him. He got the requisite skills in the military to jump out. He learned how to jump out of airplanes, and he eventually did become a stuntman for motion picture and film in the UK. And he worked on quite a few big Hollywood Hollywood features. He was in the last Indiana Jones movie, for example. And Gary was introduced to base jumping through a military buddy, and he kind of just took off with it like Jeb. He knew that this was something that he was more or less meant to do. Unlike Jeb, he had a family. He had a wife and children at home, so he was he didn't have the same kind of freedom to travel around. But he got in his head that maybe he could sort of advance his career and fill a lifelong dream by trying to land a wingsuit without a parachute. This was an idea that had kind of been bouncing around the sort of aviation community for a long time, surprisingly a long time. This idea, wouldn't it be great if you could jump out of an airplane and land without a parachute? That would be, this would be a human first. And but it had been mostly talk until the modern wingsuit made that kind of talk seem realistic. Finally, performance was catching up with human longing.
Huh. So thus became the Wingsuit Landing Project, which is Jeb at the head of that effort?
Jeb sort of gave it that name. He called it the Wingsuit Landing Project. Jeb was the most prominent and vocal proponent of the idea. I should say that wingsuits have been around since the earliest days of aviation, and during the Depression, there were barnstorming air circuses that would go travel around the country, and skydivers would perform. And in these early days, there were very primitive wingsuits. They were called bat suits or flying squirrel suits, and they were always a showstopper at these events. And some of the men who performed in these air circuses got somewhat famous for their time. And they talked about landing eventually without a parachute. But as I say, it wasn't until the early 2000s, the late 90s, early 2000s, that the modern wingsuit was created, that using modern parachute design principles that allowed for better and safer performance, that this talk of landing really started to heat up. And Jeb, while, as I say, it was a clandestine sport, and therefore a lot of people kind of kept their plans close to the vest, Jeb was probably the one who was most prominently out in the public talking about it. And while he was talking about it out in the, you know, to the media, to people like me, Gary was sort of quietly making his moves behind the scene, trying to figure it out. So the book and this quest really are about problem solving. Here's your objective. Your objective is to land a wingsuit without a parachute, achieve this human first. Well, how do you do it? And these guys all had different ideas about how it could be done, you know, safely and so that they could survive.
I don't want to give too much away here, but there's an interesting effort by Gary Bullock documented with pictures in the book as well from 3 years ago where he got close on the wingsuit landing thing. There's a section here on brains and genetics in the bird dream, Matt Higgins. Are some of us just disposed to seek danger?
I think so. Yes, there. I think again, it gets back to this idea that where the people who eventually become base jumpers and wingsuit pilots, they've been attracted to other adventure and extreme sports already at a younger age, and they just progress. And those sports are not enough for them. They don't satisfy them or leave them feeling fulfilled ultimately. And so they move on to something that's even more intense. Some people are just attracted to doing dangerous things. I mean, that's a lot of the wingsuit pilots I've talked to will say, you know, people will give you a lot of reasons why they do these types of activities, but ultimately they do it because they like to do dangerous things.
And now one of Jeb Corliss's efforts with wingsuits involved, he seems to be trying to go through smaller and smaller gaps in geological formations over time. Work us through some of the jumps he's made in China, for example.
Well, Jeb, in his quest to land, he realized that he needed to develop his skills, and he came up with a series of projects that would were more and more demanding. And in 2011, he went to a remote mountainous part of China, and his objective was to fly through this giant arch in the side of a mountain. So he would be, you know, it was like flying through the eye of a needle, except it was a massive, you know, sort of massive cavern, the dimensions of which escape me at the moment, but it was, you know, suffice to say, as tall as the Statue of Liberty, you know, several dozen feet wide. But nevertheless, he was putting himself into a situation where he would have to be so precise and fly so well for a period of time while he was going through this arch. There was no way out. He was too close to the ground to pull his parachute. There was nowhere to fly right or left. The ground was below him. And he practiced, you know, for a year or more, jumping out of airplanes, trying to get the proper flight characteristics. He was using GPS. He was using GPS technology and analyzing his flights, you know, on computer to make sure that he had just the right angle so that he could successfully fly through this arch.
So he had to figure out the pathway without the obstacles in the way.
Exactly. He simulated, and he did, of course, finally succeed. And it was the most extraordinary flight that had ever been completed at that time. Now, this was in 2011, and to give you an idea of how rapidly this sport is changing and progressing, several other people have since flown through much smaller arches. A man flew through a much smaller arch in Spain. And then just about a year ago, in Switzerland, an Italian wingsuit pilot flew through an arch that was merely 9 feet wide, not much wider than his wingspan, at 100 miles an hour. And it's staggering to think that somebody could do that. But he did, and just that's the nature of these sports. Just when you think that they've reached the pinnacle of performance, somebody goes ahead and blows your mind by doing something that you thought was impossible.
But, you know, the amazing thing to me with both the wingsuits and base jumping itself is that so much is about the flight, and then you got to think about the place they land, though. So if you jump off, for example, the bridge in West Virginia over the New River, you end up in the New River, don't you?
Well, many of them do. Standing at the bottom, watching that take place, many hundreds of base jumps take place during one day each year, the Bridge Day, they call it. It's every October. The Park Service does permit people to jump legally from the bridge. Many of them do end up in the water and have to be fished out by waiting rescue boats. But if everything goes as planned, you do land on the riverbank. But in this sport, things don't always go as planned, and you have to have a provisional landing or a plan B.
Yeah, lots of plan Bs and even plan Cs in the book. It's a pretty amazing description of what goes on out there. Bird Dream, Adventures at the Extremes of Human Flight. Matt Higgins wrote it and joined us today in the exchange. Matt, thank you.
Thank you so much, Jeff. It was my pleasure.
All right, take care.